Tonight on Arena, we look back on two iconic albums released 25 years apart, both of which were recorded by artists who died prematurely. The artists are Nick Drake and Jeff Buckley. The albums Five Leaves Left, Drake's debut in 1969, and the classic Grace, released 25 years ago in 1994, and the only complete studio album released by Jeff Buckley before his untimely death in 1997. Both singers achieved either little or moderate success in their lifetimes, but have grown in stature and influence over the subsequent decades. Alan Carr and Aoife Barry have been taking a re-listen to both artists. Let's start chronologically with probably the best known track from that Nick Drake debut. This is Riverman.
An all night show.
Riverman, the title taken from Nick Drake's debut album, Five Leaves Left. And as I said, I'm here with Alan Carr and Aoife Barry. Alan, tell us a little about Nick Drake.
Well, Nick Drake was born in 1948 in Rangoon in Burma to Rodney Drake, who was an engineer, and Molly Lloyd, who was the daughter of a senior member of the Indian Civil Service. And in 1950K, the family moved back to England and settled in Warwickshire in a very nice house in Tanworth in Arden. And Nick had a very bucolic, beautiful kind of a childhood in the countryside, and that obviously that went on to influence his music a huge amount. He also had an older sister called Gabrielle, who was quite a successful screen actress, who about the time that Nick was having his early success was appearing in soap operas like Crossroads and science fiction programs like UFO. But in any case, Nick went on to college, went to Cambridge College, also busted around Europe until then he signed to Island Records in 1968, at a time when Island Records, just set up by Chris Blackwell, was a very experimental label. It had a lot of kind of forward-looking ideas, which was quite good for the time. He went on to release three albums, the one we're discussing tonight, Five Leaves Left in 1969, Brighter Later in 1970, I should say, and his final album, Pink Moon, in 1972. Unfortunately, he sadly took his own life in 1974, and during his own lifetime, Kay, he was largely unsung, but as we'll be exploring tonight, he went on to have huge later critical and commercial success.
So Alan said there that he got signed by Island Records. Is that how Five Leaves Left came about?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was he was spotted at a benefit concert by Ashley Hutchings, who's from the Fairport Convention. He put him in touch with a man called Joe Boyd, who was a producer and connected to Island Records, and he basically invited him to record with him. Now, Nick Drake had been playing music for a number of years since he was in his teens. His mom, Molly Drake, played the piano and wrote poems, so he grew up in a household where people were making music, but not in a very big and showy way. And to prove a point about that as well, his sister Gabrielle said that when Five Leaves Left was made, she didn't really know anything about the recording or anything until her brother turned up and just basically threw the record onto her bed and said, "Here you go." And it turned out to be his debut album. Somebody else might have made a really big deal about that to their sister, but Nick Drake wasn't that kind of guy. He was a very low-key person. He was about 6'3", so he was a tall, imposing figure, but actually wasn't that imposing at all when it came down to it. He was just described by a lot of people as a bit elusive. They didn't really get a very good sense of who he was as a person, which all I think adds to that myth and the story around him.
But he did have strong ideas about his music, and he was there in the studio with his guitar, and then he had the string playing musicians around him, and it was recorded as one piece.
Very much so. I think the producer Joe Boyd, who later went on to work a lot of kind of very important acts and had already worked with Fairport Convention and Pink Floyd, later went on to work for REM. The way he describes it is that this was Nick in the studio on his own, and a lot of people debated the fact whether Nick could actually sing and play such accurate guitar playing, or plays guitar with such minute attention, the way he plays, beautiful kind of picking style. And people were always amazed that he sang at the same time he played, because at the time a lot of people were doing overdubs. Robert Kirby was responsible for those absolutely gorgeously haunting strings you'll hear throughout the album. So he had a lot of the cream of the English folk scene at the time. Richard Thompson was involved, Eddie Thompson was involved as well, people like that. So he had the best people involved, and Ireland were really kind of putting a lot of kind of faith in, you know, the success of Nick Drake. But the way he approached recording was very intimate.
And so, 1969, 50 years ago, how in tune or out of tune was he with what else was being recorded?
Well, I suppose a couple of ways of looking at it. I mean, in one way, you can look at like what was commercially successful at the time, which I don't think is always a very good way of measuring how good somebody is or whether they were in time or not. Because obviously, with this album, it's still quite timeless. That it's an amazing album, regardless of it came out in 1969 or not. But if you look at some of the bands that were in the charts at the time, so at the end of the year, you had people like the Rolling Stones, the Archies, Marvin Gaye, Fleetwood Mac, even Dean Martin. They were all really high up in the charts that year. But at the same time, you had a really strong British folk scene moving into the British folk revival. So you're talking about bands like Sweeney's Men, who are connected, of course, to Ireland, Pentangle, Fairport Convention, but they have kind of bigger sounds. And there, when you think of the accents as well, I think Nick Drake's accent is really important to his music, because his accent's quite posh, it's quite highbrow. He doesn't do a lot of kind of trilling when he sings as well. Occasionally he will do it, but not a lot, especially on the debut. He doesn't draw out the phrases, he doesn't draw out the vowels too much when he's singing. So it's not so much clipped, but it's a lot different to other singers that you might hear at the time. But it's really clearly got that folk sound. At the same time, it has kind of jazz touches to it as well, particularly on the piano and some of the songs. So he's a really interesting proposition where he is picking up that folk revival that's happening, but he's truly doing his own thing with it.
But it wasn't a commercial success. And then he, obviously there was the other albums, but then he lived as a recluse, more or less, in his parental home.
Yeah, I think, you know, It's an interesting one in that like his college days, he was known as a kind of a very gregarious individual. When he had friends, he had very close friends. He didn't make a lot of new friends. He was described as confident, almost aloof, and I suppose his lofty height of 6'3" probably helped that.
Yeah.
But as he became, more immersed in music, like, for example, in college, he was a very good sportsman. He was a very good athlete and he was very good at rugby. But then he discovered smoking cannabis. And he started withdrawing a lot more. He would stay a lot in his room, just, perfecting his guitar sound. And the more he got into the music, the more it seemed, the more withdrawn he became, which was obviously not very good for a performer. And that's largely a part of his lack of success, I think. The fact that he couldn't tour, the fact that he got very frustrated when audiences talked through his performances, that his songs took a lot of tuning. So every time there was a song ended, he had to spend 5 or so minutes tuning up for the next song. People got bored very quickly. So his personality, unfortunately, was a large part of his lack of success, I think.
And led in many ways to his early demise. Let's move on to Jeff Buckley's Grace. That's released 25 years ago this weekend. Unlike Nick Drake, it was released to great critical acclaim, but only moderate commercial success. What did you think of the album? Can you remember it at the time?
So a friend of mine who later became my boyfriend was obsessed with Jeff Buckley when I was about 16 and gave me a tape of Grace. And I knew nothing about Jeff Buckley at the time. This is back in 1999, so it was only a couple of years after he had died. And I just absolutely fell in love with the album, and to this day it's probably the most special album in my life. I just absolutely adore it so much. And the thing about it is that, and the more I think about it as the years go on, there's no other album I've listened to in all the many albums I've listened to that sound like Grace by Jeff Buckley. And the fact that it was his only album that he released during his lifetime, because he did work on a second album that was later released posthumously, but we don't know if that's exactly what he would have wanted. That's what makes it so special. There's so many different genres melding together on it. His vocals are incredible. He's a man who can reach the falsetto range. He sounds like a soul singer sometimes. He sounds a bit like Nina Simone other times, but he has that rock element that was going on. This was the 90s, the mid-90s, so you had your grunge movement happening at the time. Taps into that a little bit as well too.
So probably the most frequently played song from that album is his interpretation of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. Many think this has become the definitive version.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Faith was strong. We're discussing who Jeff Buckley's father is there. You forgot to mention that.
Yeah, the thing that you really want to mention, and yet Jeff Buckley probably wouldn't wanted us to have mentioned, was that his father was Tim Buckley, the troubadour from the 70s, who tragically died very young as well. Jeff didn't really meet his father very much. Met him a couple of times before his father died, and that was a real shadow hanging over his whole career. I was rereading the biography of his, and there was this anecdote about him being in a car with a friend who was playing Tim Buckley, and he pulled a tape out of the car radio and threw it out the window. He was that unhappy about being surrounded by stories and music of his father at points in his life.
We were talking about Nick Drake and his hatred, really, of performing live, whereas it was the opposite with Jeff Buckley and his connection with Sinead, that Irish pub in New York.
Oh, very much so. I mean, he had a huge connection with Ireland. He was initially kind of scouted by an A&R man from Dublin called Michael Murphy. And when Nick played his first gig in Ireland, it was for the Trinity Ball in 1992. And this is all covered very well in Steve Cummins' recent documentary for RT Radio. It was an excellent documentary. But he ended up staying in Dean's Grange. But the Irish connection was very strong. He played in Whelan's on the day the album was released, on the 23rd of August in 1994. Unfortunately, I didn't catch that gig, but I did see him in the Tivoli the following January, and I was in Italy the following year, and I remember making a pilgrimage to Modena, near the hometown, Modena rather, near the hometown of Luciano Pavarotti, to see Jeff play a rather long set during a storm at a communist festival. And he wasn't very good that night, but he was in great form. But he was a very, great performer, could really put it across.
And the covers he played were so diverse, weren't they? We talked about Leonard Cohen there, but he also did Benjamin Britten.
Yeah, I mean, on the album itself, you have Benjamin Britten, talked about Leonard Cohen. When he was singing live, he covered Nina Simone, he even covered Big Star, just really across all genres. He was so hugely into music. He obviously had loads of CDs, he memorised hundreds of songs, and the thing about him was when he covered a song, he truly made it his own. And I wondered sometimes about the stories that you'd read about the making of Grace, where he was quite scattered, didn't really know what he was doing sometimes, had loads of ideas. It was up to the producer Andy Wallace to kind of pull things together. Very similar story with the second album as well. He didn't quite know what he was doing, but was very talented. But when it came to cover versions, he had a structure there for him, and I think that's why he really excels. If you listen to any of the many live recordings that are out there of his work.
And was it just that he wasn't good at writing songs?
Well, I don't know. I think the songs he did write, I mean, he wrote three songs on Grace, and my favourite song by Jeff Buckley is one of the songs he wrote, which is Last Goodbye. Which is the most extraordinary kiss-off song, if you ask me. It's not a particularly nice song, but it's a beautiful song musically.
Okay, well, I don't mean it badly, but we're going to play it now. That was The Last Goodbye, the perfect kiss-off song, as Alan Corr has said, from Jeff Buckley's debut studio album, Grace, released 25 years ago. And in the company of Alan Corr and Aoife Barry, we have been celebrating their anniversary, along with the 50th anniversary of Nick Drake's Five Leaves Left.